You know what they say? Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten. And that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, your life chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just because you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on, don't give up.
Get on the bright side of life, man. This is Terrible Tommy in the bunker right back here in north central Indiana on another beautiful, fabulous day. I can't believe it. We've had 3 days in a row like this. Heard a lot of people saying if it would just stay like this, I'd be so happy. Not a cloud in the sky. Hey, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the radio show or whatever you want to send them for, because almost everybody on the list is paid up. But if you're not paid up for April, you better get paid up, because I'm going to dump you temporarily at least. You know, stores are a lot different, at least some of them. Now, we got several hardwares and lumber yards around here. Well, I went into town yesterday to get 3 boards to replace my gate that I'm not using anymore. Well, I'll tell you what happened. I measured too short. I measured the inside, not the outside length of the board. So that was my fault. My lady says, well, you should let me measure them in. I said, thanks a lot. Anyhow, I took them back this morning to get some longer ones. And I've got this one place. It's called Maynard's. I call them Maynard's or Menards, but anyhow, I like the most of the store. Give you pretty good deals. But the problem is, to turn something in like that, they have a closed yard with all their construction stuff in it. And you can't get in without immigration papers. So you go in a store, and it's a pretty big store to walk around, so you go to the counter for the rebates, and she says, okay, now here, I'll take these, and then I'm going to give you the order for these here that I got at the other end of the store. You got to go out in the yard and give it to the man. I got two copies. And I say, okay, well, can I get the money here? No, then you got to come back in and go to the counter, which is another block away. So you go out to this gate, and this is just like a military gate. they take your papers, and they check you out and look at the color of your eyes and go to the back of your vehicle and take down your license plates and all that. And finally, after 2 or 3 minutes of that stuff, said, okay, now you can go on back. So you go on back and you run into a guy that probably doesn't even have his GED, that can't find the boards I'm looking for. So I'm there for 20 minutes while he looks for the boards that are all supposed to be in special stalls. He finally finds them. We load them up, and then back out to the gate we go. Papers, please. Give him the papers. He looks them all over, and then I got to sign something. He checks the license plate and looks inside to see if that's what it is. How can you mistake a 14-foot board at 6 inches wide? What's the problem seeing that in the car? Got to open up the car and touch it. Anyhow, if you got one of those kind of places in town, it can eat up half your day, you know? So I got another hardware over here that don't do that. You just go in, you go back to where the stuff is, you get it, you put it on a cart, whip it out there, pay for it, out the door you go. That really started my day off wonderfully today. All the extra. Now, if you're building a house and going to get 20,000 pieces of lumber, I understand why they got to have that kind of security. But for 2 or 3 boards to go through like you're going into Stalag 18, no way. Anyhow, that's my bitch for today. What's yours? Oh, yeah, my water pump quit. I finally found a relay by the tank that contacts on the relay evidently got pitted, because it was a couple of times I blew a fuse, and finally traced it down. I had to trace it out through the ground out to the pump. Had electricity out there and 2 or 3 things, and finally figured it out. So now I had to take my lady's nail file and file down those contacts on that relay. You know, if I'd have called a guy downtown to come out and do that, I bet he'd have charged me $200 to figure that out. Maybe more. You got to figure out how to do things yourselves, I'll tell you. Because none of us could afford to call people out every time you have a problem. It would break you up. One more bitch. I contracted a guy to put an eaves trough on the back of my house. Well, that was 3 weeks ago, and he didn't come back yet. These guys out here are something else. They come around, they give you an estimate, and you okay the estimate, and they go away, and they don't come back. I don't know where they go. Maybe he's dead. So I guess I'm going to end up putting up my own downspout on a big flat roof up there. My lady, she gets nervous when I crawl around on the roof. But a flat roof? I can't screw up on a flat roof, can I? Well, here's an exciting subject we can tear to pieces. Confessions of a former U.S. Air Force drone technicians. Now, you better listen close to this because these drones are starting up all over the country. They're using them all over the country. And don't worry, don't fret, they're going to be armed and the cops are going to be using them. And the FBI going to be using them, probably. And all these outfits. If you don't think so, just wait around. So you need to know all about drones. Yeah. Well, let's see what one guy has to say here. Ex-serviceman who built communications infrastructure for U.S. drone program in Afghanistan speaks out against it. Well, you ain't good American. You're bad American. Sion Westermoreland was 18 years old when he enlisted in the U.S. Air Force. Now 28, the former serviceman served with the 606 Air Control Squadron in Germany. And why are we still in Germany? Tell me why we're still in Germany. Well, I know. It's to keep an eye on those krauts so they don't do it again like they did before. And the 73rd Expeditionary Air Control Squadron in Kandahar, Afghanistan, as an Air Force technician in the middle of nowhere. You know, Taliban's coming back. They're getting stronger again in Afghanistan. I think that's funnier than hell. Obviously, should have left the Taliban run it. I don't care how they run goddamn Afghanistan. Let them run it. Let them have it. If they want to put a tent on their women and all that stuff, I'm not worried about it. He built the communications infrastructure for the U.S. military's drone program in Afghanistan, which, according to a 2015 report by The Intercept, led to the deaths of hundreds of civilians. That Intercept is a lot of good information on that website. I forgot now who ran it. They're to the left of center, that's for sure.
They're going to say Metzger's a communist. I always knew he was a goddamn communist.
In 2010, after 4 years in the military, he left the Air Force and joined other whistleblowers speaking out about U.S. drone policy. A whistleblower is a person who spots a crime and wakes the town and tells the people. The group of technicians and operators wrote an open letter to the U.S. President Barack Obama. Here he tells his story in his own words. My first day deployed in Kandahar was really strange. I walked from my tent to the little box that was my office, and my boss was in there smiling. He turned to us and said, "We're killing bad guys now, boys." I had this big lump in my throat and an uneasy stomach. When I read the Bible, I learned that we're not supposed to kill people. But here I was, building the infrastructure for people to do just that. I built a data relay system. I also did guard shift, where I saw kids begging for water, and we weren't allowed to give them any water. One day I realized that I didn't load the encryption each day. Nothing would happen. Aircraft wouldn't be able to use this system to implement the drone program. They told us in the military, quote, "No bombs without comms," unquote. All you hear is voices telling you what to do. There's no physical danger from the enemy, and that's what makes the job so tough. Is that like shooting fish in a barrel? If you're in danger, if someone is pointing a gun at you, you can justify in your own mind shooting someone. But if you're sitting in Kandahar, you're confronted with a screen where you watch people day in and day out. You might even start to realize they're not bad people. Some people start to feel a connection to the people they're pursuing and start to understand their humanity. That can be traumatizing, and you have no one to talk to. When you're in the drone program, you're isolated. Operators, analysts, leaders all work separately. All you hear is voices telling you what to do. And I don't think it's from God. You're exposed to just a limited amount of the spectrum. People like me who speak out about the program feel we've been exposed to something we see as questionable. When you don't hit survival mode, that instantaneous fight or flight mode, you won't override your critical faculties, which can leave you a huge moral dilemma and no one to talk to. Wow. Quite a few civilians died because of what I was working on. Some people start to feel a connection to the people they're pursuing and start to understand their humanity, I said. That can be traumatizing, and you have no one to talk to. When you're in a drone program, you're isolated. Operators, analysts, leaders all work separately. All you hear is voices telling you what to do. I read that. What the hell's the matter with you, Metzger? You're exposed to just a limited amount of the spectrum. People like me who speak out about the program feel we've been exposed to something we see as questionable. Quite a few civilians died because of what I was working on. I read that, damn it. Whether you're a drone operator or a technician, you're still involved. When you look at the Nazi concentration camps, you had paper pushers everywhere who moved people through the lines. Didn't know what was going to happen. But like now, there are a lot of people who are responsible for civilian deaths who are totally unaware of their role. Wow. Right now in the United States, we have a military that is not accountable to the public. No shit, Sherlock. Thousands of people are in the Joint Special Operations Command, a force accountable only to the president. The nigger. Uh-oh, I said I wouldn't say nigger anymore. Not much, anyhow, but I want to tell you. I've dreamed up a new word for them. These blacks, untouchables. Yeah, a force accountable only to the untouchable. The military's out of control. Well, that's why you give anybody $1 trillion a year budget or close to it with total power over life and death over the whole earth. And what do you expect? The compartmentalization of knowledge means that by 2030, the majority of people hired could be technical support or maintenance. Who's responsible then? In the drone program, you usually do 10 to 12 hour shifts. It's a schizophrenic way to live. You have to go home after a mission like everything's normal.
What did you do today at the office, baby? Well, I blew away 14 families and a goat.
When someone plays video games for a long time, they look drained and gaunt. Imagine when there's real repercussions. It has a huge impact on people mentally, and that's probably why they developed those games in the first place, about killing people, all the war games on the electronics. To start deadening their nerves to death and carnage. Also, the public image of the program is so awful that you have guys trying to explain to their kids that they're not monsters, even though they are. When you think about soldiers being deployed and what's involved in that, well, drone operators are redeployed on a daily basis. I'm speaking for both technicians and operators here, especially the ones that work in the U.S. They're in combat situations every day with limited support and work long shifts. I wonder if they can get screwed up like air controllers.
You killed the wrong bunch of people.
speaker comes on and says, "There is no such thing as the wrong people." I had nightmares about killing children. It hit me when I was in Kandahar Air Base. On one side you have a McDonald's, and down the road there's a kid's begging for water. Those people lived an austere life, and we're sitting here from the comfort of our joystick, resolving in the idea that we're killing bad guys. Well, a lot of people say, well, they're all bad guys. Maybe they're not bad guys. Maybe we just need a few fewer bombs and more communications between people. When I got back from deployment, I had quite a number of unresolved marital issues. The nightmares encompassed everything I didn't understand. I had nightmares about bombing villages, about being bombed, about killing children and trying to save them. I was emotionally detached from loved ones and had to battle with alcoholism. Well, that's why, of course, we got about 24 military guys commit suicide every day, I think it is. And that's just one part. There's also an insidious part, the moral injury side of things, where the more you learn, the worse it gets. You're trying to figure out what you did, why you did it, and what's going on in that country. That's what brings you to a real point of hopelessness. Isn't it great how we send our young men over to do shit like this? These homicidal maniacs in Washington? Absolute war criminals? Obviously, the military don't like people speaking out. Of course not. When I first went public in 2015, I spoke out with two people who were featured in the movie Drone, and another guy who was speaking out for the first time. Initially, our bank accounts were frozen. Our lawyers posted it on Twitter. It got retweeted a lot, and then they opened them up again so we could get our money. I think the military is cautious about coming after us when we're collaborating with other groups, lawyers and activists. However, they're trying to mitigate interactions between us and people still in the program. I'm going to assume by now that they have communicated with everyone we know and everyone in the program, telling them not to speak to us. We're pariahs. We tell the truth. Right now, 12 people from the program have been in touch and are active in speaking out about their experience in the program. That number could grow, and that's worrying for them. That's the military-industrial complex. If you break the security clearance, if you speak to a journalist or an organization or leak documents, they send you to jail for espionage. But we signed up to give back to our country, and that's why we had to speak out. That's the end of that soldier's story. What do you think of your government? What do you think of... it's no big deal that he's a nigger president. I mean, untouchable president. Because all the white ones did the same thing. And all the white ones that follow the untouchable, they're going to do the same thing too. Until the whole thing collapses, till they go broke, run out of money or something, or somebody else comes around and drones them. That's not a bad idea, huh? Like I say, the cops are going to be using this stuff pretty soon, state police and so forth, so you better figure countermeasures. I worked with countermeasures for a while in Germany when I was in the army. We need a lot of countermeasures. The pro-military people will say, well, yeah, but these are terrorists over there. They're shooting us, and they're doing this, and there's bombs. There's bombs everywhere. Yes, buddies, but it's their land. It's their land. You're going over to their land. So it's a different story. Now, if the Taliban was planting bombs all over this country, every town in the country and all that kind of stuff, a drone would be perfectly legitimate thing to do to defend yourself, but not the way they're doing it here, not the way they're doing it in Afghanistan, where we really invade and occupy the country. I found a manifesto that's been in my library for a long time, at least 25 years, maybe 30. And I read bits and pieces of it, but didn't get too excited about it. But while I was traveling around lately, I decided to read it. And I came up with a lot of good stuff in here. Some stuff I didn't necessarily agree with totally. But the Eugenics Manifesto sounds pretty good, or at least a lot of it. Let me know what you think. We in the eugenics movement are not interested in competing against Adolf Hitler or Karl Marx for some minuscule little 1,000-year Reich. We're interested in competing with Jesus Christ and Buddha for the destiny of man. Eugenics and evolutionary ethics involves much more than merely the mechanics of selective breeding, like we humans were merely a new breed of cattle or a new strain of wheat. Evolutionary ethics is an entirely new understanding of man and his relationship to the universe. From the beginning of time, man has searched the far reaches of space for another consciousness and another power that could control the destiny of the universe. While we searched in vain to the ends of the universe for an unknown entity, we ourselves have acquired the power to build nuclear suns, to fly through the air like Apollo's chariot, to reach out and touch the stars, the surface of Jupiter, and to probe the depths of the sea. Powers that once were ascribed only to God. Could it be that God is not something that was, but rather something that is to be? Could it be that the universe was not the end of creation, but just the beginning? Could it be that we are involved, evolving into and becoming that very God for which we search? When man came into existence for the first time in forever, the universe could think and feel and see the purpose and direction were born amid the black chaos of space. In us, the universe has evolved into a mind and a conscious and a potential beyond that of 1,000 supernovas. All the mountains and all the volcanoes and all the suns in the universe are as nothing compared to the life and consciousness and the brain of a man. The most powerful sun in the universe could not even build so much as a table, could not think about itself, could not build a microscope to examine itself, could not build a telescope to examine the universe around it. As the most powerful organizing and directed force in the universe, man is the corporeal manifestation of the universe, trying to comprehend and control its own destiny. Perhaps we are at once the purpose of the universe and the means through which the purpose is to be fulfilled. If we are the center and focus and fulcrum of the universe, through which everything else is seen and understood and done, our value and our moral responsibility and religious significance are infinite. If we are the mind and soul of the universe, trying to comprehend and control its own destiny, our first moral responsibility must be to preserve and improve the human species, because if we do not exist, we cannot direct the destiny of the universe. Man has a tremendous ability to influence the destiny of the universe because of his highly evolved brain. While man's scientific technology is developing in quantum leaps, we are destroying the very intellectual faculty that gave us this capacity, just as surely as a pianist would destroy his capacity by cutting off his hand. Every day we're crippling and maiming the children of the future by injecting into them the genes that cause poverty, suffering, starvation, famine, disease, physical and mental retardation, causing an affected degeneration and anti-evolution of the human species. Paradoxically, we have been conditioned to believe that we are doing all this in the name of the highest morality. Indeed, we're told that it is the epitome of compassion, charity, social responsibility, and even religious duty to spend time and money maintaining the unfortunate children who are retarded and incapable of taking care of themselves. What of our moral responsibility to protect the right of future generations to be born physically healthy and mentally capable? It is only because of our highly evolved intellectual capacity that we were able to develop the technology to keep these genetically poisoned individuals alive. Ironically, we are using the intellectual capacity that made us great in order to destroy the capacity itself. The purpose of human action is and should be to increase man's knowledge about the power over the environment. Each year we spend billions on education and nutrition for our children in order to increase their power to control the environment. Yet we ignore the most pertinent and significant factors in human power, which is intelligence. The Encyclopedia Britannica acknowledges that at least 75% of the variation in intelligence between individuals is determined genetically, and only 25% environmentally. We're ready to blow the world up in a nuclear conflict between Lysenkoas, environmental determinists, fairy tales like capitalism and communism, and 2,000-year-old ghost stories that could have been written by Bram Stoker or Mary Shelley, but were too meek to take any action on a public health issue like eugenics that could directly improve the human condition without war. Now, as a sidelight to that, you hear all the time, you hear eugenics come up, and this horrible thing, eugenics. Ask any of these conservatives or liberals. They'll damn it to hell and back. Eugenic techniques are gene splitting and selective breeding are considered good when applied to plants and animals to produce advances in medicine. But these eugenic techniques be used to protect our children? He risks being labeled a Nazi or a racist. One actually hears the argument eugenics is evil because Hitler believed in eugenics. Is everything that Hitler believed in wrong, ipso facto, because he believed in it? If Galileo had been a mass murderer, would that have proved the world was flat? Eugenics is a moral commitment, not a racial affiliation. The schizophrenic attitude towards eugenics is muddled and confused further by the pseudo-intelligentsia of sectarian atheists, humanists, and socialists who think of themselves as the most liberal and objective freethinkers. Instead of entering into an honest discussion of eugenics, they categorize us as with slogans. Quote, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, unquote. This fanciful slogan is interpreted by egalitarian as a pseudo-religious, mystical, divine right of birth that is parallel to the medieval concept of divine right of kings. In the medieval times, a child who happened to be born to a king was thought to be endowed with a metaphysical divine right to control the resources of the earth and the destiny of man. In modern times, according to the divine right of birth, a person who happens to have been conceived and born because of chance combination of sperm and egg and 1,000 other happenstances is thought to be magically endowed with a mystical supernatural right to command the resources of the earth and the destiny of man. Both the divine right of kings and the divine right of birth involved in the medieval assumption that those who happen by chance and coincidence to have been born have somehow more right to control the resources of the earth than those who did not yet happen to have been born. The divine right of birth has no more validity than the capitalist assumption that those who happen to have been born with wealth have somehow more divine right to use the resources of the earth than those who do not happen to have the wealth. The procreation of children is a combination of caprice, opportunism, greed, and chance, in much the same way that the acquisition of money is. The socialists and the sectarian humanists would claim with some validity that an economic system is valuable only insofar as it contributes to mankind as a whole. To a much greater extent, this premise should be applied to the birth of each individual human being. An even more fantastic objection to eugenics comes from superstitious people who base their objection on what they call religious or moral grounds. They claim that if a child is born retarded, it could only be because it was the intention of some all-knowing and all-powerful entity who wanted the child to be born retarded. Do we really believe that a child is born because of the Immaculate Conception? Because some ghost comes down and picks one sperm out of millions and matches it alone with the egg and determines that the child will be born with Down syndrome, mental retardation, spina bifida, and clubfoot, and that would be a sin against the ghost for a human being to protect his own children from physical and mental defects? What is the difference between this attitude and that of the Jehovah's Witness or Christian Scientists who refuse medical treatment for his children? Do we have the right to determine who will be born in the next generation, and thus who will control and direct the destiny of man and the universe? We're already doing that through the tax and welfare structure. A person who accepts responsibility for restructuring society in one generation automatically becomes responsible for the effects of the restructuring on future generations. The pattern of present births is a pattern of future population. Suppose we continue to present the policy of encouraging the least capable members of the human race to reproduce by giving them encouragements, welfare grants, and rewards for bearing more children. In the end, there would be more people consuming goods than there would be people who had the ability to produce these goods. And the very people who were trying to help would starve. The existence of man depends on the genetically capable individuals, because they are the only ones who can maintain society. If the capable individuals are not born or educated, all the people will starve. In order to prevent human suffering, we must first take care of those who can maintain civilization rather than those who will never be able to contribute. It is irresponsible for any society to adopt a social welfare system as they have had today, without adopting a eugenic welfare system in conjunction with it. We must consider the future good of mankind. The premise of working for the greatest good for the greatest number is correct, but we must include in that number all the children who will ever be born in all the days that will ever be, not just those who happen to have been conceived and born and who happen to exist at this particular stage in evolution. Redistribution of life support away from the productive and creative members of the more favored sociobiological class to the less favored sociobiological class through the tax and welfare structure causes the genetic change in the next generation. we as a species will change as a result of this redistribution. And Tommy says you can see this in the population of this generation that's around us right now, and which came out of the generations of the 60s and the 50s, where all this bullshit was planted back then, and now it's in full bloom. Our present welfare system is redistributing life support systems away from the capable to the incapable, and thus reducing the genetic quality of future generations. We are indulged in unnatural selection by giving welfare to the non-productive producers. We are creating a whole generation of parasites and problem makers, and preventing birth of those very people who could solve these problems. It is not a question of beginning or initiating a eugenics program. It is a matter of recognizing that we have already begun an anti-eugenics program, which is a suicidal and disastrous one because it selects the inferior for survival and eliminates the superior. We are practicing eugenics in reverse. I've said that many times, that we're practicing dysgenics. I see this fellow that wrote this book use the word dysgenics too. We're causing the reversal of evolution. Since we are already manipulating genetics, we should be made conscious of our responsibility for the results of our actions on future generations. We're responsible for what our children will be. We can no longer plead ignorance. We have a voluntary choice to make between the superior and the inferior, between prosperity and starvation, between evolution and de-evolution. Doing nothing is a choice and a disastrous one. Shall future generations consist of people who are fertile or of people who can contribute to culture and civilization? Opponents of eugenics claim that man is a tool-making animal now that genetic improvement is no longer necessary. The fact is that the level of civilization that a life form can maintain is a direct result of and is delimited by the intellectual capacity of that organism. Intellectual capacity is genetically determined. Environmentalists claim that man can fly now, but it has not been necessary for man to develop wings through genetic mutation. The sea otter, also a rock, has a tool to open oysters. The 20th century science of Earthman are as paltry as to the other's rock compared to the infinite achievements open to us if we continue genetic as well as cultural evolution. Those who allow man only mechanical innovation while prohibiting eugenics improvement are dooming the children of the future to live the life of a rat in a Skinner box. The constant degeneration of the human species caused by the present dysgenics welfare system will result in our children becoming crippled by genetic defects. Is the fate of mankind to become a quadriplegic vegetable hooked up to a life support system from which he can never be released? Because of our mind, careless, irresponsible, neurotic, cowardice, we are jeopardizing the very survival of the human species. Eugenics is not cruel. On the contrary, it's a highly expression of concern and love for the children of the future. The suffering in this world is not caused solely by the environment, but partly by genetics. This, the cure for poverty, ignorance, or famine must involve genetic improvement. Poverty, ignorance, and starvation can only be eradicated by removing the genetic and environmental combinations responsible for this human suffering. The cause of our suffering is within us. The source of our salvation is also within us. I notice a footnote here. Some of the ideas in this chapter are from Sex vs. Civilization by Elmer Pendle. Some of you people probably have read Elmer Pendle's books. Well, that's it for now. The next chapter gets a little sticky when he talks about race, but we'll go into it tomorrow.
Yes, we will.
Well, you thought Chicago was bad as far as the murder rate? Well, I'll tell you, Indianapolis, Indiana, the biggest city in Indiana, but far smaller than Chicago, had 15 murders last week. 15 murders. How about that? So the Black Ku Klux Klan, the Untouchables, are very busy in the state of Indiana. East Chicago, Gary, all that. And Indianapolis. And Fort Wayne. Well, I hope you got all your popcorn and beer ready for this evening, the big election in New York City. And when what a candidate says, you know how those New Yorkers are. You know what he's talking about. Drew's got his ass in a jam on that one because everybody computes it as Jew. Or streets full of nigger. I mean, untouchables. So anyhow, it's going to be quite an evening. If Trump blows this thing out, then they're going to really go nuts. And the chaos builds, baby. I love it. I love it, love it, love it. I suppose you know by now Hillary Clinton's nothing but a money-hungry bitch. And if there's a hell, she's certainly from it. And I know there's no hell, but she's making it here on Earth. Let's listen to this.
Check this out. Now, some have spoken about this, but now Clinton emails have revealed the actual reason that she ousted Gaddafi. And yes, these emails expose Hillary Clinton's true masters. Absolutely insane when these emails hit. My friends, Sputnik News is reporting that a declassified email exchange between the former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and her advisor Sid Blumenthal shows that Clinton was up to her eyeballs in the Western conspiracy against Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi and his Pan-African gold dinar currency. That's according to William Engdahl, who's made these statements after reviewing these emails. It states here that a recently declassified email from the illegal private server used by the ex-Secretary of State and Democratic presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton during the Washington-orchestrated war against Muammar Gaddafi shed some new light on the U.S. establishment's genuine motivation. Quote, in a newly classified Clinton email from Sid Blumenthal to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton dated April 2, 2011, Blumenthal reveals the reason that Gaddafi must be eliminated. Engdahl made this article, he revealed it in a magazine, New Eastern Outlook, quote, using the pretext of citing an unidentified high source, Blumenthal writes to Clinton, according to sensitive information available to this source, Gaddafi's government holds 143 tons of gold and a similar amount in silver. This gold was accumulated prior to the current rebellion and was intended to be used to establish a Pan-African currency based on the Libyan golden dinar, he writes. Quote, by 2008, the prospect of sovereign control by a growing number of African and Arab oil states of their state and oil gas revenues was causing serious concern in Wall Street as well as the city of London. It was huge liquidity in the trillions. They potentially no longer would be able to control it. Meanwhile, in 2009, Gaddafi, then president of the African Union, offered the states of the continent to shift to a new currency independent from the U.S. dollar, the so-called gold dinar. And the rest is history. See, Gaddafi was getting ready to challenge the central banking monopoly of the planet, the Federal Reserve, the banksters. And what did they do? They took him out. See, he did not want to be linked to New York. He did not want to be linked to London. He wanted to have currency independence from U.S. control. That's what he wanted. He wanted to be free from that. You know, if you look back, I mean, how long was Gaddafi, you know, holding down al-Qaeda? And I mean, he was, I mean, we had some pretty reasonable relationships as far as I can tell. And then all of a sudden, he's about to launch a gold dinar, challenge the banksters, and like that, Hillary Clinton arms the rebels, they take him out, Christopher Stevens ends up being one of the casualties of the American side. And then what happens next? ISIS takes control of Libya, and then you've got arms being dumped into Syria, the complete destabilization even further of the Middle East. All because, at least for Libya's sake, the gold dinar about to be launched. See, if Africa is able to stand on its own with its own gold currency, they'd be able to prosper. They would be able to keep their money inside their local, you know, country. And that's really where all the power is. It's local. It's not when you, submit to these central bankers. That's why local currencies are so powerful. And there's a lot of them out there. Anyway, amazing revelation coming out of that server that Hillary Clinton has.
Well, if you listen to the show, you heard me tell about this a long time ago. We're talking about, what, 3-4 years ago when it was rumored that Gaddafi was going to do it, and I said, they're going to kill him. Of course they're going to kill him. And they did kill him. Gaddafi should have been smart enough to know and did something to protect himself. I don't know whether it would be anything he could have done, but that's the way it goes. And the only trouble is by spreading that gold dinar around Africa to all those African nations with all those corrupt dictators down there, they'd have grabbed that damn gold and been gone living in Paris, you know. So I don't know how much that would have solved. I don't think that would have ever done any good as far as I'm concerned. It is amazing how these guys like Gaddafi and different people that have been dictators around in South America and all over the place trusted these bastards. They trusted them. And you got to know, I can tell you, that they're going to screw you, man. You know. Yeah, and the ones they've assassinated in South America and all over the place, shit. You got to kill them before they kill you. That's the only way to do that. And these people in the third world don't have brains enough to understand that you got to go for the throat of these bastards personally. You know, you got to do it. Otherwise, you're going to be toast. Love crimes are on the rise, man. Love crimes. I mean, you know, I'm not going to call hate crimes. They're love crimes. Here's one. Here's a good one.
Modesto City Schools taking up the subject of race at Monday's board meeting.
But I remember very well of what this school district has done in the past, over and over and over.
The district listened to frustrated parents and civil rights leaders.
Well, he's been jumped by 6 boys, okay, telling him to go back to Africa.
For failing to properly handle alleged hate crimes against African American students.
And they sprayed him with whipped cream. With shaving cream, telling him that he needs to be white.
Nufeir Hassan is a subject of a civil rights investigation by the U.S. Department of Education.
And he started saying stuff like KKK and getting in my face and saying Ku Klux Klan.
The then 12-year-old Modesto student spoke to KCRA in September about incidents involving 2 white students who are brother and sister. The students were disciplined, but the school also sent Nufeya home for a few days.
She was the one that had been scratched in the arm. She was the one that had been jumped on, so why were you suspending my granddaughter?
School board president Stephen Greenbow acknowledged more could have been done.
Yeah, I think there probably was some mistakes then, but hopefully we cured them.
Adding, the district has introduced several new programs and is making great strides.
The district is aware of all our problems, and we've been working diligently to alleviate them. So we'll get done. Sooner or later, they'll get done.
A deep-rooted issue with a difficult answer. In Modesto, Vicki Gonzalez, KCRA 3 News.
Modesto, California, what a racial garbage can that is. And this is all over the country. I mean, it's all over the country, and the kids are reacting to it, and the untouchables have been so coddled and protected that when it happens to them, they go apeshit. If it happens to a white kid, oh, well, that's the way it goes. You've got white privilege. What you crying about? But tick, tick, tick. The pot is boiling. Worse is better. Chaos is coming. Chaos is here. This is a riot, boys and girls. After being mistaken for a KKK member, priests distribute how to recognize us pamphlets. A Dominican friar was on his way to get yogurt earlier this month at Indiana University when students at Indiana University mistook him for a member of the Ku Klux Klan and lodged a big complaint and demonstrated. Well, it's not too far from wrong, because the church committed more so-called hate crimes than the Klan could ever commit. Especially back with the Catholic Church, they murdered millions. That makes the KKK Johnny come lately as far as killing anybody. It's ridiculous. And I don't think that the Klan would not allow a Dominican priest to join the Klan. You never know who you're confessing to nowadays. Boys and girls, we got a new movie coming out, man. Come on. Actor David Aronovich. Jew? Maybe. Plays a Ku Klux Klan leader named Ernest Walters in the upcoming indie thriller Imperium. That's an interesting title. Starring Daniel Radcliffe. Imperium tracks an FBI agent, Radcliffe, who goes undercover to disrupt a local terrorist group's effort to make a dirty bomb. Directed by Daniel Ragusa, the film is based on the real-life experiences of FBI undercover agent Michael German, who spent years inside the militia and neo-Nazi groups in the U.S. I never heard of that guy. He recently answered a few questions about his role in the film. How self-recorded video auditions have changed the casting game for him and his career trajectory in Hollywood. Wow. Wait a minute. Let's see what else I can find on this. Tell us how your acting career has evolved over the years. You gained national notoriety playing Rusty in those mid-20 or 2000 Bud Light commercials, but you've since landed several notable supporting roles, including your upcoming part in Imperium alongside Daniel Radcliffe. Well, my acting career thus far has been a bit of a marathon, not a sprint. I started out kind of like, I guess, many other people, just getting the feel of the scene, building up confidence and skill, figuring out how to navigate through the way it really is versus how many say it is. Thanks to my skill in speaking Russian fluently, I was able to get my foot in the door and have a pretty cool part in the hit TV show JAG that seemed to be at first sort of the breaking point, and I started getting a bunch more auditions after that. Well, anyhow, the name of the movie is Imperium, and they're going to whip the Klan again. Poor Klan, poor Klan, poor Hollywood Klan. Well, that is Hollywood Klan. The whole movie is Hollywood Klan. How about that? Tell us about your research for the role of the Ku Klux Klan leader. Google, and Google seriously, though. Google well, Google YouTube, a great ebook, and the production recommended that, and some great conversations with the director, General Daniel Raguzis, who was very helpful and clear about the type of non-cliché and regular-looking character he wanted me to portray. One funny story, when I arrived, I got picked up by this great African-American female driver. And as we were driving back to the accommodation, she told me about a real-life KKK compound in town. Wow. Let's see what that's all about. Too good of an opportunity to pass up, so we drove by it and saw the Confederate flags and other signs, and I asked her to drop me off, and I was going to go in and do some research. We joked about how she couldn't go in with me. Then I decided to against it. The director was happy about it. Well, if this was in Hollywood, where in the hell is this Klan headquarters? I guess the Hollywood Klan's got a Klan headquarters in Hollywood. How about that? Wow. What was the most challenging thing you faced on the set of Imperium? The rain. There was one crowd scene, without giving anything away, and it took us a couple of days to film. It started raining, and it was raining on and off for the next couple of days. I was wearing a big green Grand Dragon robe, which could easily get ruined, so I always had to hide alongside the help of a couple of very nice PAs that were always on standby with umbrellas and towels to keep my Klan ass dry. Wow. Anyhow, that's about that from that movie, Imperium. I'm sure it's not going to follow the book, Imperium. Or am I mistaken? Well, that's it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day. That's right, David Lane's favorite day. So we're off and clear, and you take care of yourself, and stay out of the rain, or you'll be Houstonized.
I'm going to pay that kind of money, you know, good Aryan money. I know you guys are still Christians there. You enjoy some of this we're going to put on today, but if you really get upset by attacking religion and the request that we tax the churches, well, then you better cool your heels this today and come back for the show tomorrow. Because here we go. Here is Tommy's Church of What's Happening Now at Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern.
In the bullshit department, a businessman can't hold a candle to a clergyman. Because I got to tell you the truth, folks. I got to tell you the truth. When it comes to bullshit, big time, major league bullshit, you have to stand in awe. In awe of the all-time champion of false promises and exaggerated claims, religion. No contest. No contest. Religion easily has the greatest bullshit story ever told. Think about it. Religion has actually convinced people that there's an invisible man living in the sky, who watches everything you do, every minute of every day. And the invisible man has a special list of 10 things he does not want you to do. And if you do any of these 10 things, he has a special place full of fire and smoke and burning and torture and anguish, where he will send you to live and suffer and burn and choke and scream and cry forever and ever till the end of time. But he loves you. He loves you, and he needs money. He always needs money. He's all-powerful, all-perfect, all-knowing, and all-wise. Somehow, just can't handle money. Religion takes in billions of dollars. They pay no taxes, and they always need a little more. Now, you talk about a good bullshit story. Holy shit. Thank you.
you to know. I want you to know something. This is sincere. I want you to know, when it comes to believing in God, I really tried. I really, really tried. I tried to believe that there is a God who created each of us in his own image and likeness, loves us very much, and keeps a close eye on things. I really tried to believe that, but I got to tell you, the longer you live, the more you look around, the more you realize something is fucked up. Something is wrong here. War, disease, death, destruction, hunger, filth, poverty, torture, crime, corruption, and the ice capades. Something is definitely wrong. This is not good work. If this is the best God can do, I am not impressed. Results like these do not belong on the resume of a supreme being. This is the kind of shit you'd expect from an office temp with a bad attitude. And just between you and me, in any decently run universe, this guy would have been out on his all-powerful ass a long time ago. And by the way, I say this guy because I firmly believe, looking at these results, that if there is a God, it has to be a man. No woman could or would ever fuck things up like this. If there is a God, if there is, I think most reasonable people might agree that he's at least incompetent, and maybe, just maybe, doesn't give a shit. Doesn't give a shit, which I admire in a person, and which would explain a lot of these bad results. So rather than be just another mindless religious robot, mindlessly and aimlessly and blindly believing that all of this is in the hands of some spooky, incompetent father figure who doesn't give a shit, I decided to look around for something else to worship, something I could really count on. And immediately, I thought of the sun. Happened like that. Overnight, I became a sun worshiper. Well, not overnight. You can't see the sun at night. First thing the next morning, I became a sun worshiper. Several reasons. First of all, I can see the sun. Okay? Yeah. Unlike some other gods I could mention, I can actually see the sun. I'm big on that. If I can see something, I don't know, kind of helps the credibility along, you know? So every day I can see the sun, and it gives me everything I need. Heat, light, food, flowers in the park, reflections on the lake, an occasional skin cancer. But hey, at least there are no crucifixions, and we're not setting people on fire simply because they don't agree with us. Sun worship is fairly simple. There's no mystery, no miracles, no pageantry, no one asks for money, there are no songs to learn, and we don't have a special building where we all gather once a week to compare clothing. And the best thing about the sun, it never tells me I'm unworthy. Doesn't tell me I'm a bad person who needs to be saved, hasn't said an unkind word, treats me fine. So, I worship the sun, but I don't pray to the sun. Know why? I wouldn't presume on a friendship. It's not polite. I've often thought people treat God rather rudely, don't you? Asking, trillions and trillions of prayers every day. Asking and pleading and begging for favors. Do this, give me that, I need a new car, I want a better job. And most of this praying takes place on Sunday, his day off. Not nice. And it's no way to treat a friend. But people do pray, and they pray for a lot of different things. You know, your sister needs an operation on her crotch. Your brother was arrested for defecating in a mall. But most of all, you'd really like to fuck that hot little redhead down at the convenience store. You know, the one with the eye patch and the club foot. Can you pray for that? I think you'd have to. And I say, fine, pray for anything you want. Pray for anything. But what about the divine plan? Remember that? The divine plan. Long time ago, God made a divine plan. Gave it a lot of thought, decided it was a good plan, put it into practice. And for billions and billions of years, the divine plan has been doing just fine. Now you come along and pray for something. Well, suppose the thing you want isn't in God's divine plan. What do you want him to do? Change his plan? Just for you? Doesn't it seem a little arrogant? It's a divine plan. What's the use of being God if every rundown schmuck with a $2 prayer book can come along and fuck up your plan? And here's something else, another problem you might have. Suppose your prayers aren't answered. What do you say? Well, it's God's will. Thy will be done. Fine, but if it's God's will and he's going to do what he wants to anyway, why the fuck bother praying in the first place? like a big waste of time to me. Couldn't you just skip the praying part and go right to his will? It's all very confusing. So to get around a lot of this, I decided to worship the Son. But, as I said, I don't pray to the Son. You know who I pray to? Joe Pesci. Joe Pesci. Two reasons. First of all, I think he's a good actor, okay? To me, that counts. Second, he looks like a guy who can get things done. Joe Pesci doesn't fuck around. In fact, Joe Pesci came through on a couple of things that God was having trouble with. For years, I asked God to do something about my noisy neighbor with the barking dog. Joe Pesci straightened that cocksucker out with one visit. It's amazing what you can accomplish with a simple baseball bat.